Well, you are about to experience quite the episode, but before you do, I just want to give a quick reminder that we are doing something special for our 100th episode. And if you have been impacted by this podcast in any way, positive, negative, neutral, we would love to hear about it, okay? So please call this number, 650-349-1132, and dial my extension 117 and leave a voicemail about your experience with the podcast. And you are giving us your consent to use that if you do leave us a voicemail, unless you specifically say, do not use this. We just want you to know. But we would love to have you featured on our podcast on our 100th episode. With that in mind, without further ado, here's this week's episode. You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Okay, a couple things to start off with before we get started here. One, you need to know this. Rachel, I think, already knows from yesterday. I'm having a chomper issue. The old chomper has come loose. I had a dead tooth, and they gave me veneers a couple of years ago, and I went hog wild on some jerky, ripped it right out.
Hog wild on some jerky.
We went to Bucky's. They have a Bucky's out in Tennessee, and they have at this
when
one.
Were you, hold on. When were you in Tennessee?
Over Thanksgiving.
Oh, this is a while ago. I thought it was like this past week. I was I've seen you every day this week.
There's a new advancement this week.
Do you know what Bucky's is?
Yeah.
Bucky's is insane.
I know.
It was the most stressed I've been in a very long time when I was in Bucky's.
Did the Bucky's you went to have a beef jerky bar?
I don't know if it had the beef jerky bar, but it had like pulled pork and cheese Danish. It was the weird. It was like
27 different flavors of soda.
It was like Hobby Lobby, a food court, Walmart.
Oh yeah, and Bucknugs.
Bucknugs. Was Bucky there? The mascot?
Bucky was. I mean, not the mascot. The little statue outside.
The little golden cat. Yeah. Bucky.
But the beef jerky. But I love beef jerky so much, and it's like as much as you can possibly imagine. And they just serve it fresh. Anyway. But it's cold, and I just ripped through it. Yeah, and my tooth was actually sticking in it, my veneer. Anyway,
that is like so on par for Bucky's that someone's chomping on jerky and a tooth comes out like that plays.
So I have this little embarrassing little nub below the tooth. Everyone has a veneer; they shave it down to like nothing.
Yeah.
Where I just
fingernail
crazy.
Size, pretty much.
So I managed to like stick it back on until I went to the dentist, and the dentist fixed it. But recently,
it's come loose again.
It's come loose.
Did he tell you to lay off the beef jerky?
Well, I think it just needs. I need a new veneer, which is unfortunate. But all that to say, I have to watch how I say my F's.
Yeah. Do you say them as B's?
Well, I say them eps. Yeah, kind of like almost what? Like a P.
Yeah, I think
because if I say F right now, my tooth will fling at you. If I say it hard, or if I sneeze, found that one out on the golf course.
Did you sneeze? You sneezed.
I
your
sneezed
tooth
on the golf course, and my tooth was just chilling on the green, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And the guy's like, "What are you looking for?" I was like, "Ah, my tooth, my ball marker."
What if you used your veneer for your ball marker? It might be a nice little tee, too. You could like flip it upside down.
But I did just, when I found it, just picked it up, put it right back in.
Oh, gosh.
The old chomper. I brush it now at night. I take it out and I brush my little tooth. I'm getting new veneers next
week. Just for the record, this is not the way this podcast was. You did not tell us we were going to start with this. This is catching me really far off guard. Oh, gosh.
Also,
what does Katie think of your veneer? Do you take it out at night? Like, do you set it on your nightstand?
Yeah, but it's like, no one knows, you know? Like, I don't show the family because they just, they look at me different.
As they kind of should,
yeah,
I think.
They're just like, oh, your whole body is falling. You can't even keep your teeth in your head. Poor dad, he really is getting old.
He's really getting up there.
I'm like, no, I just love jerky. There's a difference.
It is traumatizing.
Anyway. Oh man, that's
The other thing, number two.
Number
is,
two,
Rachel. I have to ask you a question. You're gonna have to be honest with me here. Is that a vape pen?
No, it's a pen that says "Choose kind."
It looks like a vape pen. Okay,
it's just actually, a regular.
Okay, it's
add that to the list of things I'd pay good money to watch Rachel do. We talked about her cussing last week, didn't we?
Like, that'd be great.
Couldn't even imagine that, but I couldn't imagine her with a vape pen either.
The other end, though. No, I'm just kidding. It's a highlighter.
And Lindsay and I's first apartment ever had two interesting things about it. The first, it was above a veterinary clinic. So there was above this clinic, there was two apartments. And so we just heard dogs barking constantly.
That sounds
24/7.
Did you foresee that?
Yeah, we did. That. I mean,
you're like, we can deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, we were newlywed and had next to nothing. And so it was like, that's a good price. We paid like $900, I think, a month. And that included all utilities. Like it was amazing for like a two-bedroom apartment above a veterinary clinic. But the other thing is right across the street, like across a parking lot, it was a vape bar.
Oh.
Or no, it was a hookah bar. It was a hookah
bar. Yeah, the hookah lounge.
And so there was just people all the time over there hanging out at the hookah lounge.
There's not actually like tobacco and stuff in that,
right? I have no idea.
Is it just like flavored smoke?
Yeah, I have no idea. But
cube formed smoke.
That was it.
Hypothetically.
But my actual question for you guys, now that we've gotten those two things
out
of the way.
Let's get down to business.
Yeah, now we're going to get to the real stuff.
The real stuff.
We're talking revenge here. Talking retribution.
Retribution.
All right, and I want you to reach back to the archives of your life. At what point did you ever face a scenario where you really wanted revenge? Not necessarily that you did get it, but although I do want to know if you got it.
Yeah.
Or even if you plotted it. Like, I could see Rachel really wanting revenge and plotting it, but not actually going through with it.
Okay. Yeah. So here's the story that came to mind. It's adjacent to that. It's not quite revenge, because it was...
Jason?
It was about my friend Jason. I had a friend Jason, actually, growing up. Revenge. Jason Lehman.
Lehman Brothers? What's Lehman Brothers? That's a thing.
It is, but I think it's like a... But it's not...
He's not part of the Lehman Dynasty?
He's not part of the Dynasty.
All right.
But this was middle school, and I don't even remember who it was, but I was talking to this cute girl who was like the cutest in the class, and I was trying to act all like cool and whatnot, and this kid came behind me and pantsed me right in front of her, which is like classic middle school record.
That is and trauma, dude. Like,
and it was me, you know, I was trying to like impress her and everything.
Oh.
And in that moment, you freeze, right? Because you don't expect your pants to drop.
No.
You're like, so I literally like stand there and I like look down and I look up. And it's like, just like a cartoon, like I'm just frozen. And then all of a sudden, I pull my pants back up. And I chase this kid down immediately. So this is the revenge I was seeking.
Yeah.
And I immediately just run up and I shove him with two hands. And he falls, right? It was like at this corner of a building. And he falls into the walkway of, if you were walking on the other side of the building. And who walks up at that exact moment but the principal?
Oh.
And the principal watched me just shove this kid and has no context as to why. And I got in so much trouble for that.
You understand? Like, I just had my pants off. Yeah. I was just talking to her with my pants off. You gotta understand.
Wouldn't have helped. So that was
a bad rage.
Oh, it was a bad day. And there was a rage in me for whoever. I can't remember who it was. I've erased him from my memory.
But that's amazing.
I'm sure he had a crush on her too. That was it.
That's so cold. Can you imagine if adults did that to each other? Just like at church, you're just standing talking out in the courtyard and someone comes up behind you.
I'm going to walk up to you and try to make you sneeze now so your tooth can go flying. That's what I'm going to end up doing. So you're going to make your tooth fall out.
That's how we handle offense here.
Yeah. Anyway.
Pants.
I don't know. It's not quite what you're saying,
that's the story
that came to mind.
You got revenge.
I got revenge.
Yeah.
But then he did, ultimately, because I got in more trouble. He got to pants me and I got in more trouble. He won that exchange.
Oh,
Chad. No. It was probably a Chad.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Chad. Yeah. How about you, Rach?
I was thinking back to middle school, but I clearly remember a day, I was 6 years old, and my neighbor Jack didn't want to play with me.
Jerk.
And we played together every day, but he didn't want to play with me, so...
Not that day.
Yeah. I was really upset and got really mad and then started walking back into my house. But then he started coming towards, like, moving towards the garage. And at that point, I didn't want to play with him anymore. So yeah. I threw a little pebble at him, and my sister shut the garage door. As it was closing, I threw the pebble, and that was it. I didn't play with Jack for 2 days.
Two take whole that, days?
Jack. Wow, you take that.
Oh.
Don't take it back, Jack.
Right? Jack must have been suffering.
No.
He was devastated, I'm thinking. Yeah. But, was there a reason he didn't want to play with you that day, or he just woke up and chose violence that
day? Yeah, what part of the story are you not telling us, Rachel?
I don't know.
He just had a bad
day. He just
day.
Wasn't feeling the treehouse that day, wasn't yes. I don't know.
Ah, treehouse.
But
kids are so
mean. The best
mean,
part
man.
Was that my sister joined me.
Yeah, she did.
Her role was shutting the garage.
Person. Yeah. She thought that was pretty mean. She's so not like, mean at all.
You hurled the pebble, and then she was like, no, Jack.
But the door like slowly closes.
And still no. It's like halfway down.
Who's more mean, you or your sister?
Oh, for sure me.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does that just mean that you both are so nice? Or are you meaner than you let on?
I think I'm better at hiding it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Don't ever cross Rachel.
I know.
That's what I'm learning.
I kind of want to now just to see.
I think I would like to say I've changed, but yeah. But I'm but we'll still see. More mean than she is.
But we'll see.
I'm still capable of more evil.
I had a kid he was really nice to me at church. And then at school, he was not nice to me. And this one day, I was just like so fed up with it. And this was like sixth grade. So first year in junior high. And I was new to the school and everything. And I tried to talk to him and he wouldn't talk to me or whatever. And he did something mean. I don't remember what he did. But I was so mad. I was like, I need to make him pay. And so I found a tack and put it on his chair. And I was like,
that's
this
like Bugs Bunny stuff. And like, that's classic.
Looney yeah. Tunes. I was like, this is not going to work. I mean, of course he's going to see the tack, but I'm going to put it there just so he knows, you know, and he didn't see it at all. He sat right down on
plopped
it.
Plopped straight on it.
Plopped on it. Like stood up, immediately started crying. Went up to the teacher. The teacher looked out at the scan at the crowd and saw my
up.
Face where I'm like,
it wasn't I.
Like it was like, I did it. And I was like, I didn't. Play expect cool, this
play
to
cool,
work.
Play cool, play cool, play cool.
So it was like, it was bad. It was like, you punctured his skin. You stabbed him.
You stabbed him?
I was like,
stabbed
yeah,
him right
I did.
In the butt cheek. You got him.
Why? Because he wouldn't talk to me. Oh, well, we don't stab people.
Did you get in trouble? Did you get detention?
Oh, yeah. I went to the principal's office and.
The whole nine yards, huh?
The principal's like, yeah, you probably didn't. This is not how you saw it going down, huh?
Like, nope.
No. But he did pop up just like Bugs Bunny, man.
I remember my brother. So my brother's 4 years older than me and my sister's 6 years older than me. So they're pretty close. And when we were growing up, my brother at some point like got mad at my sister and ended up hitting her, which was like, and this is probably when he was, you know, 6 years old or whatever, which is a huge no-no in general. But in our house, my dad like made a huge point. You don't hit girls, right? So my brother gets in trouble and he goes to his room and then my dad gets home from work and my dad starts talking to my brother, Vic, and he goes, Vic, your mom told me you hit your sister. Is that true? My brother just goes, yep. He goes, do you know what happens if you hit girls? He goes, yep. And it's the punishment was getting spanked. And so my dad puts him on his shoulder, spanks him. He looks at my brother and he goes, was it worth it? My brother goes, yep. And just walked off. I was like, that's awesome.
Transaction done.
Yeah, exactly. Calculated and worth it. She deserved it.
So theoretically, because you talked a lot about principles, every one of our revenge stories has some kind of principle that is violated. Mm. And we feel justified or we feel like we have the right to justice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, in your case, your principle is no one should pants you.
Yeah, exactly.
Public embarrassment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what would
public
you say?
Decency.
I kind of heard you saying, maybe I'm reading too far into this, Kevin, but I'm listening through the lens of, like myself and a lot of other people that might think, you know, there's this old country song, you got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense in like we hold our principles near and dear to our heart.
Yeah.
And you kind of had mentioned that a principle is good until it's not.
Yeah.
And yeah. I just maybe wanted to start a little bit in that direction. Like, at what point does a principle start breaking down? Because we're about to talk about a specific principle that sort of sits in the back of all of our minds.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah. Well, I think I think as you said, or as I said, principles are good until they're not. And that's partly because principles don't take into consideration the nuance and the complexity of the world. By nature, a principle is reductionist, right? It's trying to take a broad view of something and simplify it into a small statement or, again, principle to live by. But the world is just more complex than that, right? It isn't just black and white. Now, that isn't to say there isn't necessarily just plain right from wrong. I think we can, you know, determine that. But I think all of us, you know, the more you live, the more you realize the complexity and nuance of life, which is, I think, why you watch kids develop this sense of kind of moral complexity as they get older, because they're wrestling with, like, I was at a park yesterday with Adley and one of her friends, and Adley was playing on this playground with a bunch of kids that we didn't know, just from, you know, it was a local city park, and this group of boys kept running and trying to climb up the slide, and she wanted to go down the slide, and so she was like stuck at the top and she just wanted to keep going down. And finally, she's like, I'm just going down. And she like took him out on the way, which was awesome. She's like, I'm just doing it. But it was funny because her and her friend run over, and they were so distraught that these boys weren't following the rules. So they run over to me. They're like, above the slide, there's a sign that says you cannot climb up the slide.
Like, it's called a slide, not a climb. Yeah,
exactly. And they were like, they couldn't imagine that someone would just break the rules, right? Because developmentally, where their brain is at, is it's more in concrete thinking. Like, that's the rule. And so therefore, why would you break it? You can't break that rule. Now, my analogy is breaking down because I don't know if there's like a morally good reason for them to climb up the slide. But the sense is like where they're at is they see that and they say that's how the world should operate. And that's a good principle. You shouldn't climb up slides because they're slides, not climbs, right? But at some point when you get into more nuanced things, and the example I used in my sermon was that of lying, right? A principle of not lying is good and one that we need to teach. And I would probably argue 90% of the time abide by. But there are, in fact, those moments in which the morally correct thing would be to not abide by that principle. So again, the example I use, which might be extreme, but it works, right, is like if I'm hiding Jews from the Nazis and they knock on my door asking if I'm hiding Jews, the morally right thing would be actually to lie. And most of us can sense that would be the right intuition. So I think it just comes down to that idea, again, that morals or principles are good, healthy things, but they're simplistic things in a world of moral complexity. And so how do we balance that tension is difficult. Like, I don't know. I mean, can you guys imagine you guys, well, what do you think of that tension? And are there principles that you guys kind of think through that are like, yeah, that's a bit simplistic, but the world is nuanced, and so it poses opportunities maybe where you have to bend the principle a little bit.
Yeah, I tend to be less rigid with principles, and I think that is viewed as has been viewed as a weakness over the years. Like, someone who doesn't have the wherewithal to stick with a principle when they feel like it needs to bend.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about everyone who would say, well, if you don't stick to your principles when it gets hard, but I guess in your Nazi analogy,
yeah,
that's not necessarily the principle's hard. It's more like there's a moral obligation.
Yeah, well, I think what you're kind of getting at too is there's a distinction between, how do we word it? Moral principles, kind of the way you said it, versus, like truth, I think is what you're getting at. Like a concept of like, if I don't stand for the truth, I'll stand for nothing. Like that's kind of true, but it's different. Like the word principle, maybe I'm using it a little bit differently in that it's a little bit more of,
how the world operates, opposed to like, I don't know if I'm making sense. I think I feel like I'm talking in circles, but yeah, there's a nuance to it in some way. You know what I mean? Opposed to like how we guide our moral action in the world versus like, what are the ultimate belief statements I'm making, which still have room, I think, for nuance. At least the more I live, the more I realize things are much more complex, even in there is ultimate truth, but it's more complex than I usually give it credit for.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting, you know, in the biblical library of texts, right, which is, you know, our scripture, we're in a section that would be known as the wisdom literature that includes Proverbs, that includes Job, and includes Ecclesiastes. And what's interesting about these is Proverbs is essentially a book of principles, right, that offer really good advice and things that you should abide by the majority of the time. And so it's chock full of principles. I find it really interesting that after that book, we get the book of Job in the same wisdom literature.
Yeah, interesting.
Which is in some ways, I think, communicating principles are good until they're not, right? Mm. That the world is morally complex, and how God operates is also morally complex. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's almost like the biblical narrative itself is trying to hold together that tension. Principles are good, but they don't always work properly.
Yeah.
And it takes wisdom to discern how we interact with them.
Hmm. I think you may have said this in your first message on Job, but or I've heard you say it somewhere, but like when we read the Bible as like there's a tendency for us to want to read the Bible as like a prescriptive rule book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there's if we get a dogmatic principle, it feels comforting to us. Okay, I know that's what we do and that's what we don't do. Mm-hmm. But reading Job, in fact, like what his friends are doing, it actually causes some ways that, you know, problems with the ways that, you know, we view God, and mm-hmm. brings up character issues for God if we follow these principles so strictly mm-hmm. and dogmatically. So,
yeah, it's one of the, we look at the Bible like an encyclopedia from the modern world. Like we kind of think of it in those terms. And so I think of, okay, what does the Bible have to say about friendship? And then I go to it and I look for things about friendship. The problem with that view of the Bible, that the Bible is a sort of reference book, I forget the way you'd worded it, is that the Bible does have truths about the world and about us, and it answers all those big questions that humanity's asked for all time, but it doesn't do so through reference or prose, right? It does so through story.
Yeah.
And it does through narrative. And so we aren't as used to understanding or deriving meaning from narrative than we are reference book.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, quite frankly, we live in a world where if I have a question, I just Google it and I probably find some halfway decent answer, you know? And so our brains are just quite literally wired in that way. But to understand like something like suffering, like if you were to Google, why do we suffer? That's a much different question. And so the Bible, I think, actually takes a pretty brilliant approach and says, here's a story of suffering.
Yeah.
Here's a story of of who God is and how God operates in the world. It's just, again, that takes more work. You know, the Bible has the answers, but it doesn't just lay them out simply.
Yeah.
And I think there's wisdom in that because the world's complex. And so in different seasons of life, we can read different areas and parts of scripture and they hit us differently because that's the beauty of narrative. That's the brilliance of the biblical authors. We're opposed to, I mean, think of like the difference between a legal code versus like a story, right? Legal code is, you know, in section 16A(b)(3) or whatever, it says this and it legislates the thing. Mm. That's one way to do it, but literally the possibilities are endless.
Yeah.
Wisdom is a much more appropriate way in order to view how we operate in the world.
Not to belabor this point, but isn't what we're talking about here some of what makes us tired when it comes to like politics? Like people, like, you know, people that are like, this is what's going to fix the world. And this is the way, you just have to do this. This is the solution. But like, we all kind of know, like the solution has got to be way more nuanced, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be like rolling out whatever solution you have is like, and I just, when I read stuff, I'm just like, man, it feels, it feels endlessly complicated, and I'm very wary of oversimplified answers.
Yeah. And the reality is, in that example, we probably need both. You need legislation, and you also need to, like, the complex humanity has deeper issues downstream that are producing these sorts of behaviors or whatnot. And so, like, law, which is in the biblical narrative, given to us as a gift and a grace of God, is in fact a way in which it's a gift to humanity to help organize behavior. But it's correct in that it doesn't ever change the heart of the human. But it doesn't mean you can't do that either. So that's where, again, principles are good until they're not. It's one thing to, you know, post the speed limit sign in a neighborhood that says 25 when children are present. And that's a good thing, and we need. And some people, like, that's the only thing that's going to deter their behavior is that sign and the potential of consequence. But it's a whole nother thing for an individual to say, oh, it is dangerous to drive faster because I'm endangering the lives of others.
Yeah.
And whether the speed limit sign is there or not, you're gonna drive safer, right? Mm. They get at the same thing, but they're two different things.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's how principles operate. It's trying to create an environment for a healthier living, if you will.
That's good. So the friends kind of roll out this, they reveal their principle that they're kind of thinking of. They look at Job's life and, you know, they say, well, you know, you must have done something.
Yeah.
Because look at you.
What's happening.
We don't even recognize you. Like, what have you done? You know?
Yeah.
And they kind of go into this thing where they say your piety should be your confidence.
Yeah.
And something about, like, have the in it, like, innocent never, what do they say? The innocent
they go on
never
and
perishes
they,
or...
Let's see.
Have the innocent never suffered?
Yes. Yeah, verse chapter 4, verse... Why am I missing that? Verse 7? Yeah. Consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? And this is Eliphaz, again, laying out his view of how the world works, which, by the way, Job actually buys into this way of the world operating as well, which we'll see in this coming week. But again, he's going to come at it and say, I've done nothing, I'm innocent. Therefore, the problem isn't the retribution principle. The problem is that God is breaking it, right? That he is unjust.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be his case against God. And we'll wrestle with that. But that's where Eliphaz begins. He says, do the innocent ever perish? And that's because, again, beneath the surface of Eliphaz and his friends and Job, and I would argue many, many of us without actually explicitly saying it, we believe that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. It's just kind of what the assumption is beneath the surface. And so that question that Eliphaz asks is, he's looking at Job and saying, do the innocent really ever suffer? He's assuming Job is answering, no, the innocent never suffer. It's only the wicked. Because that's the operating principle beneath the surface for the for those in the story. But again, as I mentioned, to me, it's if we think about that question for any length of time...
Yeah.
It's clear that the innocent suffer in numerous, numerous ways. And so it's tipping our hand a little bit already at how we would disagree. Again, if we think through it consciously, the world doesn't operate that way. The innocent do suffer and the wicked do prosper, right? Like that's part of a broken world. That's part of a broken humanity, that we see that inverting of it.
I was trying to invoke the retribution principle when I was asking Rachel about Jack.
Yeah, yeah.
And saying, what did you really do, Rachel?
Like, yeah.
Jack didn't just decide he doesn't want to play with you.
Yeah.
I must have done something.
You must have done something wrong.
Yeah.
I was moving in on
that guy's girl. That's apparently what I was doing. He's like, I'm having none of that. Literally, so, you know, middle school Kevin had no chance with her anyway. Yeah. Goofy Kevin in middle school. Man.
Hey, is that a snort?
That was a little bit of a snort.
I haven't heard you do that before.
It's because I'm a little congested today. The sun's out.
I thought maybe that meant maybe
middle
more
school
of a
Kevin
genuine
was coming
laugh.
Out. Oh, yeah.
No, I'm not a snorter when I laugh, but every once in a while when I get congested, maybe I am. I just did. I shouldn't be in denial. Wow.
I like to think that you snort only when it's a genuine laugh.
No, I
not
have
a pastoral laugh.
Yeah, not your pastoral.
I just
laugh.
Came across that picture, by the way. That's a throwback to the OG listeners.
Oh,
if they
man.
Remember the pastoral laugh.
Yeah, we'll put that in the notes.
Like, it's been a while since I've been self-conscious about my laugh. Here.
So you
Welcome
talk
back.
About. So you said the retribution principle, and you kind of. No, it's more of a really cool. One laugh, two laugh.
Now I'm like laughing but not trying to laugh at the same time. Oh man!
So talk about these half truths. That you the first one suffering as a result of sin.
Yeah.
And you said something interesting here that I want you to unpack a little bit, that we, that when we do this, mm-hmm. We create an environment where we can only connect with God out of fear. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Again, I think this gets into the tension between what we profess we believe versus how we actually live. And that's where these half-truths kind of come about, which, just a side note before we get to that good question, is this is one of the things that makes Job really hard to interpret. Is Job, his friends, Elihu, this other friend that comes later in the story, all say things that are kind of true. Some are true, some are not. Some things they name in the midst of the whole dialogue. And so become like the reader really has to pay attention to exactly what's the logic as they're unpacking it. And this is one of those. Like, the assumption is from the friends and Job is that suffering is a direct result of someone's sin. And again, what I tried to unpack is that's kind of a yes and no. It's yes in a meta level of like Adam and Eve brought sin into the world. And so therefore that fractured creation and downstream from that is all the death and suffering that we experience. But we take this into the micro scale where it's like the reason I didn't get that parking spot is because God's mad at me. Or the reason I was late to the, you know, to work or whatever, or the reason I blew my tire out on the freeway was because God must be angry with me, or I didn't read my Bible enough or whatever it is. And I think that there's a lot of dangers to this kind of thinking, but the one that you referenced, Brandon, is it puts us in the position with God where we only deal with God out of fear. Mm. It's again, going back to maybe the speeding thing, like the only reason I abide by the speed limit is out of fear of somebody catching me and then giving me a ticket. And that's, you know, again, that metaphor might break down, but like, that's not a, it's not a freeing way to live. Right. And when you relate to someone like God in that way, like none of us want our children to interact with us in that way, or we wouldn't want our friends to live out of just pure fear of whatever, of retribution or whatever it is. And so that environment of like, I don't want to suffer, and I know if I sin, God will punish me. And so that's the only lens through which you view God. And it creates an unhealthy relationship with God, who again, I think is not the vengeful, angry God that we tend to project onto him. And so it again, yeah, I think it creates that environment in which it's the only way that we relate to God. Mm-hmm. Like, does that, I mean, maybe a good question I'd have for you guys is, do you see that? Cause I have found, I'd put it this way. I surprise myself how frequently I end up living in that way with God. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, even if I name it and preach a sermon about it, it still pops up in different corners. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what is your, like, do you guys experience that same sense of relating to God out of fear?
Yeah, it's not so much in this half truth of that suffering is the result of sin, but it does feel like, and maybe this is healthy, but it does feel like there is a fracturing that happens when I sin. Mm. So it does feel, I can sometimes feel removed and separated from God.
Yeah.
When I sin, although I don't feel like that's coming from God, I feel like it's coming. So I guess that would kind of be suffering because I feel.
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think what you're getting to too is true, right? Like there is when sin takes place, if we think of sin through the lens of like a fracture in relationship, then of course there's going to be a separation felt. Yeah. I mean, in some ways that's the natural consequence bit that we talked a little bit about is if. You know, and again, map that onto any relationship with a friend, a roommate, a sibling, a spouse. If a fracture takes place, some sort of, again, what we would say sin, some sort of sin takes place in that relationship, you will feel that distance. Right. And so there's a naturalness to that, but I love what you said there, Brandon, at the end of like, but it does matter how we think of it, who it comes from. Mm. Is it just the result of brokenness or is it the active retribution of somebody? And that's a very different perspective and a different thing that happens. And again, my hunch, at least, again, speaking of my own experience, as well as I think when I sit with people and counsel people, they tend to have this view of God so frequently that God must be angry with me. because I didn't get that promotion,
or at least he's disappointed,
yeah,
you know, or you know,
and so he's withholding or whatever,
yeah.
When you know the reality is, maybe the reason you blew your tire out is because you hit a pothole,
yeah.
Like maybe it's just it's just happened. It's just a thing.
By the way, Kevin keeps using this analogy, and he used in Second Service at least to use the bent rim. That really happened to him last week. You can tell that's sitting heavy on your.
It was a little bit of, so that happened to Lindsay. That happened to my wife last week, and I used it kind of jokingly to see if she was listening. She was. She smiled when I said it, which was really funny. By the way, someone came after me. So First Service, I said that example: driving down the freeway, you pop a tire and you bend your rim. And I'm not even kidding. Someone came up to me after First Service and said, that happened to me 3 days ago. That exact scenario. And I was like, that's crazy. That happened to my wife. It's really funny. But
it's like, the heavy. Lord is speaking through you.
But it does happen more often than I think, if I think about it. Like even with getting sick, I remember last year I got sick and it was COVID, of course, but I don't know if you need to say that on the podcast. But I just remember talking to someone in my community group and I was like, did I do something to like get sick again? She's like, do you not get sick usually? I'm like, not this sick, or like not to the point where I have to stop doing things or be by myself. Like, does God want to teach me something? She's like, well, maybe there's things you can learn in being sick, but sometimes you just get sick because there's sickness.
Yeah.
And the world's broken.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting for a while thinking like, oh, was there something I did? Like something I said?
And you know, this, the other way I see this pop up often too is people can scapegoat their own misgivings on God through this. And what I mean by that is like I think of how many times when I was in school, I'd like pray before an exam, like, God, I've been real pie. I've been saying my prayers, like it's time for you to show up. And then I'd fail the test. And it wasn't because God didn't show up, because I didn't study.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, but then I'll project that
onto
God.
Where were you, God?
Why didn't you show up? Don't you love me? And it's like, yeah, I love you, and you should still study, you know? Yeah. And we can play that game as well, where it's like, no, you just weren't prepared. Like, you didn't actually do the work you needed to do for whatever the thing it is. And so it just becomes this, again, a way to manipulate or try to manipulate God or manipulate our circumstances. Or just again, kind of over spiritualize things and it becomes this weird thing. When in reality there's some things that just happen. You know, it just happens. It's part of the free will that we have.
I want to bring up something that maybe I'm just thinking out loud here. So this is a little dangerous, but I was just thinking about like there is an element here where we have to untangle consequences and even like principles of flourishing that confuse all of this, that kind of where karma gets like the idea of karma or this retribution principle gets its way into our thinking and we attribute all kinds of stuff. But here's what I was thinking. That's kind of weird. I know a lot of people that are Mormon.
Yeah.
And there's a disproportionate amount of Mormons that are financially and on other terms, like according to like the American dream, like doing great. They just have stuff going on. Are we going to have to delete this later?
We'll find out. Yeah. We'll find out in a moment here.
And I'm just thinking about that. And you know, I think like the Mormon friends that I have talked to attribute that to God's favor. The prosperity gospel attributes that to God's favor. So I feel like, I don't think it's a right theology, but I feel like, that stuff kind of breaks its way into our thinking sometimes. And with the Mormons thing, I was trying, and maybe the way I was explaining it in my head is there are principles that are in this world that help us. If we live a certain way, we do flourish. And just because we stumble upon those principles, I mean, it could be as simple as like being good at business, you know, or whatever, doesn't equate with God's favor or God's lack of favor. So I guess I just wanted to maybe untangle that a little bit. Does that make any sense, Kevin?
No, it
really
does.
Confused looking.
No, it does. I think in the same way that natural consequences can happen from our morally bad actions, natural consequences can happen from our good actions.
Yeah.
in the sense of, you know, like, I think a good example of this is you look at, if you look at any, like, let's take someone like Michael Jordan, clearly athletic from birth, like given the sort of God-given talent and ability that others don't have, right? If you match that with someone who doesn't work hard, he's just probably just going to happen, right? Like, it's just going to, okay, yeah, he's a guy. Maybe he'd have a good career or whatnot. But when you listen to any story of Michael Jordan, like, one of the things that set him apart was just his unbelievable work ethic and his drive and competitive passion. Like, that coupled with a sense of, like, he was, you know, born with a disposition towards that. Like, it doesn't mean, like, that was a recipe for success, regardless mm-hmm. of where it kind of stems from. It didn't just happen, but yet it was also like a product of his free will and his drive to, mm-hmm. to work well. So I guess what I mean by that is there is a sense of, like, the world does still, it's not just happenstance, like, the world does mm-hmm. operate in a certain way.
Yeah.
But it is also, like, we have to recognize, if I had the same drive and passion as Michael Jordan, I still would not become Michael Jordan, right? Like, mm-hmm. for a litany of reasons. I wasn't born with the same athletic ability as he had with that particular gene
pool. It'd be interesting to see how far you would have gotten now.
It wouldn't have gotten very far, I don't think. But you know what I mean? Like, I guess
you would at least
is,
D1?
Who knows? I don't know. Probably not. but you get what I'm saying. Like, the world is just so complex that there are, in fact, times that, and things in this world that do produce success or whatever it is, but it doesn't guarantee it, you know? And again, like, we don't want to cage God in either, you know, spoiler alert, but Job at the end of the story is actually, gets his life restored.
He does get
prosperity and all that sort of stuff back.
Ruin it for me.
You know, but where we go awry is when we place that rigidity on it, that, like, the prosperity gospel says, no, if you sow this or reap, sow this, you'll reap this.
Yeah.
That isn't necessarily how the world works. Sometimes, but sometimes not. And we impose a rigidity on it that doesn't exist.
The other two half-truths, repentance avoids suffering.
Yeah.
And you reap what you sow.
Yeah. Yeah, so the repentance, you know, means you won't suffer. I mean, this is, at least for me, it's a clear downstream from the first one, is therefore, if my sin is what God is now inflicting suffering on me, then if I just repent, that would, you know, stop the suffering. Mm-hmm. But that's not also the case. Because again, we live in a world in which it's morally complex, and the effects, I think we talked last week about the idea of, like, chaos theory, that mm-hmm. what one action does impacts a whole bunch of other actions. Like, maybe a better way to say it is, like, if you've seen Back to the Future, right? Like, that whole movie is essentially based on this idea that if I go back in time and change one thing, a whole bunch of things change too, with a litany of unforeseen changes. And in some sense, like, repentance views life like that. If I just stop the action or whatnot, then suffering will also cease. But that's not the case. Like, again, brokenness just exists. There are influences and forces outside of our own control that cause pain and suffering. And it again puts us in the position of us controlling history, us controlling the story, and manipulating circumstances to make God do what we think he should do, which ultimately, again, doesn't ever work out that way.
I love when you said that this whole reap what you sow thing, it strips the world of God's grace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How?
Yeah. Well, again, like, if a strict principle of I reap what I sow means that I am, you know, according to scripture, deserving of death. That is what sin, I should say, that's what sin reaps. That's what sin earns, is death. And so without any sense of, like, grace is an intrusion on rigid principles.
Yeah.
It just is. It is essentially saying, I'm not going to abide by that particular principle. And so grace intervenes, intersects, and changes the situation in a way that is undeserved. That's the nature of grace. And so when we live by that strict, rigid principle, it just crowds out the ability of God to say there's a different story happening, pushing towards that redemption that I closed the sermon with. There is no room for that, because how could you, right? That's how the world operates. But grace is in some ways antithetical to how the world operates, because it just, like oil and water, it doesn't mix, because it is actually a backwards reality from the perspective of this world.
And I think you mentioned, God forbid, we actually reap what we sow.
Yeah. Gosh.
Because that's woe.
Yeah.
Woe is me.
Woe is me for sure. Yeah. For sure. You know.
So how do you think, like, if you look at this as an overarching kind of thing that we all deal with, how do you think it leaks, like, into our daily lives? Like, in what way does it really cause, maybe to kind of put a bow on this whole thing, what problems does it actually cause?
Yeah, I think it, you know, I think when we're, like, one of the questions behind this series that I've been wrestling with, or wanting to, for us as a church to wrestle with, is what do we do when we're disappointed in God? Because I think that happens often, where we think we had a vision of the way life was going to go. We had a direction in which things were going to turn out, but then they don't come out to that way. And often that's then where suffering takes place. So it could be something like, again, the death of a loved one, a diagnosis, a career ending early, a marriage dissolving, like all those different ways in which life turns out different. And how do we meet God in those places? And I think that's, in some ways, this past Sunday was about how do we clarify, or at least allow the vision of God that we have to come to the surface, so we can wrestle with, instead of projecting onto God that he's the source of all brokenness or whatever it is, that just may be too simplistic of a way to view God. Mm. And I think one of the things that breaks my heart is often watching, when life falls apart like that, people project onto God what may or may not be God. And then kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, if you will, like throwing out God in a moment where he might be more readily meeting you in your pain than you were realizing. So I think that's a little bit of the hope, is that it's that the questions are more complex. The world is more complex. Suffering is more complex. And cheap, quick answers kind of place God into a box that he's larger than. I think that was a little bit what I was trying to aim at. And I think that article by Tim Keller that I opened with really wrestles with, as he was like, man, I've been working with people in these moments my whole life, but now I've got the diagnosis. Can I actually, where does my faith land?
Yeah.
And his realization that, gosh, you know, culture had shaped my vision of God more than I realized. I think that's true of a lot of us. I think it's certainly true of me. That often God is smaller than I think I've, I think I have a big view of God, but I actually have an increasingly small view of God, and circumstances tend to bring that to the surface.
Do you have anything to say about that, Rachel?
That's good. No, I love what you said at the end. You said the grace of God pushes us to see that God is more open, or just like bigger than what we, what we make him to be. And then you even said the basis at which God invites us to the table is based on his goodness, not ours. Because if we start to think down the path of the retribution principle, then it becomes so much more about what we do or don't do rather than what he's done.
Yeah. And that's where, I mean, that even just swells up, can so quickly swell up into all sorts of arrogance, right? That if then I'm not suffering and life's going well for me, look how great a job I'm doing. Yeah. Look at the way I'm holding it together.
Yeah,
man, God must be so proud of me, you know? And and it distorts our own ego in that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You said this fosters in us humility and gratitude, because kind of on the flip side of that, like being sick example, it's like, does that mean that on the other side that I think being healthy is because I did something right?
Yeah.
It's like, no, it has nothing to do with that. Like, I could sleep well and eat well, but it doesn't guarantee health. Like, that's still a gift from God. But
We have the problem of pain, but you also have the problem of good, of like, where does good come from?
Yeah.
Right. And that's that same sort of principle at play. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me think, like, how different do you approach suffering if your view is like how you ended, that God is not about retribution? If that was, if your view of God, if you just knew whatever's going on, I know that God is not about retribution, but he's about redemption. Mm. It completely changes the way that you sit in that suffering.
Yeah.
It completely changes the way that you engage God in that suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
It's, you know, I think, and imagine you guys have probably had this experience, but being a pastor working at a church, often I'll run into people, you know, downtown or at the bookstore or at the grocery store or whatever. And if they recognize me, one of the first things they say is, oh man, like I've meant to be at church the past few weeks or whatever. Like it's just, it's been busy and I'm like, it's totally fine. You know, like that's like, life is difficult and complicated. I get it. Or other times when I talk to people who aren't churched and they find out I'm a pastor and they're like, oh, if I stepped foot on campus, God would just strike me down. And all of this is this outworking of just this heinous view of God that, again, he's somewhere around prowling, waiting for us to fail so he can strike us down. And to me, like, what is it like to live with that kind of view of God that says, if I step foot on a campus, God would strike me down? Like, man, what a poor view of God. And I don't mean that in a shame on them sense. I mean it in a, that must be a weight to carry.
Yeah.
That instead of to be able to step into the grace and the open arms of God and recognize him as a God of love first, man, like that's liberating. And the more I stumble into that, the more liberating and profound it is to know that God does in fact love me more than I could imagine. And yet at the same time, I'm more sinful than I could imagine. And those two things aren't necessarily in conflict. But rather God loves me in the midst of those and is working towards healing those broken areas that bring about sin too. I don't know. Like it makes me sad when I hear people say those things, not again out of a shame on them, but out of like, gosh, that's a lot of weight to carry, to think that there's a God that is so angry that he can't wait for you to step on campus to like smite, you know, to smite you.
Yes. To smite you.
Smite you.